about the state of abortion rights in states with conservative legislatures. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about NYC for abortion rights and some of the campaigns that we're working on. And then I'll finish by talking a little bit about the movement for Medicare for All and tying that into the movement for abortion rights. So abortion restrictions have ramped up in recent years, and especially in the past 6 months, with conservative legislatures passing fetal heartbeat bans, restricting abortions after a so-called heartbeat is detected as early as 6 weeks into pregnancy, which is before most people even know they're pregnant. As Rachel said, so states have passed more than 400 restrictions on abortion since 2011, and 378 abortion bills have been introduced by state legislatures this year alone. And nearly 40% of all U.S. women are now living in counties without an abortion provider. So some of the many restrictions include 33 states which prohibit the use of state funds to pay for abortion, 11 states that restrict coverage of abortion in private insurance plans, 18 states that mandate women be given counseling before an abortion that can include the false claim that there is a link between abortion and breast cancer, which is a very common myth, 27 states that require a waiting period between when a person receives counseling and when the procedure is performed, and 37 states that require some type of parental involvement in a minor's decision to have an abortion. At least 16 states have introduced measures to ban abortion as early as 6 weeks into a pregnancy, and Alabama legislators recently passed a bill banning abortions at any stage with very limited exceptions, and calling for doctors who perform abortions to be treated as felons and face up to 99 years in prison. Republican Governor Kate Ivey signed the Alabama bill into law, saying, "Many Americans, myself included, disagreed when Roe v. Wade was handed down in 1973. The sponsors of this bill believe that it is time once again for the U.S. Supreme Court to revisit this important matter, and they believe this act may bring about the best opportunity for this to occur." Louisiana lawmakers passed a fetal heartbeat bill on May 29th with no exceptions for rape or incest, and it was signed into law by anti-abortion Democratic Governor John Bel Edwards. The bill would require an ultrasound prior to an abortion and subject doctors to perform abortions after a heartbeat is detected to a $1,000 fine or up to 2 years in prison. As of February, there are only 3 abortion clinics operating in Louisiana, which is a state with more than 1 million people of reproductive age. Georgia Governor Brian Kemp signed a bill on May 7th that would ban abortions if a fetal heartbeat can be detected. The bill does contain exceptions for medical emergencies as well as for rape and incest, though the person seeking an abortion would be required to file a police report. Several TV and film production companies have responded to the ban by announcing they will cease operations in Georgia, which has become a very popular site for filming due to its tax incentives, so that's gotten quite a bit of attention. Mississippi Governor Phil Bryant signed a fetal heartbeat bill in March. Exceptions are to prevent a woman's death or her risk of impairment. A federal judge on May 24 issued a preliminary injunction that blocks the law from taking effect in July. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine signed a heartbeat bill in April after similar legislation was vetoed by former Governor John Kasich before he left office. There's also another bill that was introduced in Ohio in April that would ban most private insurance coverage of abortion. Kentucky passed a fetal heartbeat bill in March, but a federal judge stopped it from being enforced. Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson signed a bill in March that bans abortion after 18 weeks, which is 6 weeks before the standard set by Roe v. Wade. There are medical exceptions for medical emergencies and for rape and incest. Utah also passed a similar ban, a law banning abortions after 8 weeks. The law was also blocked by a federal judge in April. In Ohio, Republican Governor Kim Reynolds signed a heartbeat bill in May of last year, but a state judge struck down the law this January. And in Missouri, Governor Mike Parson signed a bill into law that prohibits abortion after 8 weeks. It does include exceptions for medical emergencies, but not for rape or incest. And Missouri's last abortion clinic, which is located in St. Louis, has recently come under attack. The state health department has refused to renew the clinic's license. So a judge has kept an injunction in effect, so it's allowed the clinic to continue providing abortions until August, despite it now operating without a license. So things are pretty bad in Missouri. And Missouri is one of 6 states now with only 1 abortion clinic left. So none of these laws have gone into effect yet. Many of them have been challenged in court. And in many cases, that's the point. The backers of these legislation hope that it will serve as a vehicle for the Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade, allowing any state to ban abortion. Many abortion opponents, though, were actually not supportive of the recent six-week bans. They think that the Supreme Court has signaled that it wants to move more slowly when it comes to revisiting Roe. And they are kind of getting this from the fact that there are more than a dozen abortion cases that are already one step away from the court. So justices could use any one of them to re-examine Roe, and so far hasn't chosen to do so. Many observers think it's more likely that the court will choose to weaken the protections in Roe rather than overturn it completely, giving states more leeway to restrict, legal leeway to restrict abortion. So how did we get here in the first place? Why has the reproductive rights movement been in decline for 40 years, even now, when our right to abortion is hanging on by a thread and already non-existent for many? Why have liberal reproductive rights nonprofits, Planned Parenthood, and many abortion defenders been in appeasement mode when what's needed now are bold demands and a mass movement to support them? Groups like NARAL Pro-Choice America, following the Supreme Court's reasoning in Roe v. Wade, emphasizes privacy, saying we should be able to make personal decisions without intrusion from politicians. Many seem content to protect what little we have left, and legal activists in the nonprofit sector reassure us that the legal strategy to protect abortion rights through the courts is in full swing. And some feminists seem ready to cut our losses, and they're preparing for a post-Roe America by encouraging people to learn how to perform abortions themselves and advocating for misoprostol, a medication that induces abortion, to be made more widely available, which are all great, but it's just not enough. It's understandable that Planned Parenthood, long a vulnerable target for abortion opponents, would be more defensive and do what they can to protect their, to preserve their funding and their right to operate. But their strategy of emphasizing all the services they provide other than abortion, as they say all the time, only 3% of the services that they provide are abortions, and of throwing all their support behind establishment pro-choice Democratic politicians who they see as their best chance of protecting legal abortion, has clearly been a losing one. The strategy of relying on reproductive rights nonprofits and pro-choice Democrats has gotten us into this defensive position. We need a new strategy. And it's clear from looking at public opinion polls that the level of support for abortion rights goes up when the level of social struggle for abortion rights is high. We can see this in polls showing that support for abortion was highest in the late 1970s when the women's movement was at its peak. The feminists in the women's liberation movement in the 1960s and 70s had bold demands and slogans like repeal all abortion laws and free abortion on demand. They were tired of fighting for small reforms to the abortion law, like exceptions for rape and incest and the right to an abortion if you already had four children. These feminists were told that to oppose abortion reforms and demand the total repeal of abortion laws was asking for too much. Kathy Sarah Child of Red Stockings, a radical feminist group formed in 1969, said, "We just knew that we didn't want to fight at all if it wasn't going for what we really want, that abortion reform was just more insult and humiliation for women." So Roe v. Wade was never the repeal of all abortion restrictions that radicals had demanded, but many feminists considered the victory worth settling for, despite the limited framework of patient privacy rights that lay at the foundation of the decision. And of course, a serious bipartisan backlash began almost immediately. After Roe, Congress passed the 1973 Helms Amendment, which banned foreign aid going to abortions. Defying a veto threat from Gerald Ford, Congress passed the Hyde Amendment in 1976, and Democratic President Jimmy Carter signed it into law in 1977, denying abortion coverage to Medicaid patients. So Medicaid had been covering 300,000 abortions a year. After the Hyde Amendment went into effect, it only covered a few. And that's kind of where things have stood for about 40 years. NYC for Abortion Rights, we were formed in 2017 to counter-protest a group of anti-abortion activists who planned a rally outside of Planned Parenthood as part of a National Day of Action to demand that the organization have all federal funding revoked. Despite pushback from Planned Parenthood, who asked supporters not to counter-protest outside of the clinic, citing the chaos and confusion it would cause for patients, a group of about 150 of us went ahead with a counter-protest, and we outnumbered the antis by at least 3-1. Since then, we've held a number of counter-protests and clinic defenses, both at Planned Parenthood in Lower Manhattan and at an independent abortion clinic in the Bronx, where a few of our members helped to set up a permanent group of volunteer clinic escorts working directly with the clinic. So in the past year, we targeted a church in Soho, which leads its congregation to harass and intimidate patients at the Planned Parenthood clinic down the street on the first Saturday of every month. We've successfully delayed the anti-abortion protesters from reaching the clinic by up to an hour, and we stand next to their sidewalk counselors who position themselves in front of the clinic entrance, trying to dissuade patients from entering, and hold signs with arrows pointing to them saying fake clinic escort, which they really hate. We chant things like, "This church harasses women," while we protest outside of the church, and we switch to singing songs of solidarity when we reach the clinic, showing our support for patients entering and shifting the mood a little bit. We've had a lot of support from many neighbors around the clinic. A lot of them have joined our actions and say that they're thrilled to see people finally challenging the church who've been sending congregates to harass patients for years with absolutely no resistance. Some of the clinic escorts have thanked us for being there, and we've seen many signs of support from patients and passersby. Our clinic defenses are very well organized, with experienced marshals leading us and many members trained in de-escalation tactics. So even though we always have a heavy police presence, we are unified and calm and clear about our goals. So we've had a pretty contentious relationship with Planned Parenthood, but we have made progress by working with them on other pro-abortion actions. And we've recently met with them to discuss ways that we could support each other outside of our disagreement over the strategy of clinic defense. We partnered with Planned Parenthood as well as a number of other organizations, including National Women's Liberation, People's Power Assembly, Abortion Access Front, Shout Your Abortion, DSA Soch Fem, and Reclaim Pride in a demonstration in Times Square. This was about a month and a half ago. It was against Focus on the Family, who was sponsoring a huge pro-life festival. The abortion opponents bussed in thousands of supporters for the rally, angered by the passage of the New York Reproductive Health Act in January, which expanded abortion rights and eliminated several restrictions on abortion in the state. That was a really big win for us. So NYC for Abortion Rights has also made connections with other groups around the country doing similar clinic defense work, including Seattle Clinic Defense, Twin Cities Clinic Defense, Madison Abortion Defense, and Jane Sidewalk Counselors for Choice in Everett, Washington. We shared strategies for defending clinics, including dealing with antis and with police, confronting hostile pro-choice clinic supporters who disagreed with our tactics, and recruiting people to join us and pitching media to cover our actions. So we formed a movement. We called it Movement for Abortion Defense. We got a handful of stories written about our so-called controversial strategies for protecting abortion rights. So we had a couple pieces, including one in the Daily Beast and one in Rewire. And it kind of got us asking, like, is clinic defense such a controversial strategy? We didn't really think it was when we started doing this. As clinic defenders, you know, we feel that we're responding to the anti-choice politicization of the clinic. We believe that public protest is a tool for building social movements, and that ignoring anti-abortion protesters will not make them go away. In our actions, we confront antis directly. In the tradition of clinic defenders in the late 1980s and 1990s, who mobilized in huge numbers against violent groups like Operation Rescue to keep clinics open. As right-wing attacks on clinics are on the rise again, we aim to reclaim the space in front of clinics, end the shame and stigma around abortion, and build a grassroots movement for abortion access. Anti-abortion harassment targeting clinics, like other forms of right-wing violence, is on the rise. 34% of clinics reported severe violence in 2016, up from 20% in 2014. Antis have effectively claimed abortion clinics as their own, created a powerful narrative of shame and stigma around abortion, and they've radicalized a whole new generation of right-wing misogynists who are really willing to use violence, as we've seen. So we believe in defending clinics because we see that as part of building a movement for abortion rights and reproductive justice, and we're only going to be able to build that movement by making big demands and challenging the growing right-wing anti-abortion forces wherever they show up. So I'll just very quickly talk a little bit about the Medicare for All stuff, and we can go into that later if we have time. So the demand for abortion has had the most success historically when it's been joined to larger goals of women's liberation. Recognizing that abortion is not something that can be won as an isolated issue, but as part of wider demands for reproductive justice and expanded social services. Bernie's Medicare for All bill, which was introduced in 2017, includes comprehensive reproductive, maternity, and newborn care. So Bernie has stated that under his bill, abortion would be fully covered without exceptions. And the new Medicare for All Act of 2019 that Pramila Jayapal's introduced also calls for the repeal of the Hyde Amendment. So we were just kind of like brainstorming that it feels extremely important that you know, any plan for single-payer health care explicitly addresses HIDE and includes coverage for abortion care. And how do we make sure that that happens? If we don't defend abortion as part of Medicare for All, we're going to undermine our central claim that healthcare is a universal right. We know that past attempts at healthcare reform have always compromised on abortion. Obama's executive order after the passage of the Affordable Care Act reaffirmed HIDE for public insurance and actually extended it to private plans purchased on the state insurance exchanges. So we've seen what happens in the past. So how do we make sure that that doesn't happen in the future? We really think that if we make concessions like cut concessions for abortion care, that there'll be other concessions demanded by the right, including things like maybe coverage for gender confirmation care or for pre-exposure prophylaxis for HIV prevention. So carving out abortion or any other service from a single-payer bill will just create the way for the profit-driven insurance industry to keep running. If Medicare for All doesn't cover abortion, then these companies will step in and offer supplementary and expensive coverage, and it'll just reinforce the two-tiered healthcare system that we have right now. So how do we go about connecting the two movements, which most, like right now, kind of have two separate groups of activists working on them? I think we just need to keep in mind that we do not have a single demand, that abortion rights can't be isolated from the other issues that we need to fight for, including universal health care, paid parental leave, free public education, affordable housing. And we also need to recognize where the opposition is going to come from. So conservatives could try to derail single payer through abortion as well as through care for trans people and coverage for the undocumented. Let's see, so this is going to take a multi-pronged approach and the need for a mass movement of grassroots activists who aren't tied to the agendas of individual politicians or nonprofits, but are united in our demands and capable of turning people out to rallies, marches, sit-ins, speak-outs, creative direct actions, and civil disobedience. We need to run for office and hold our elected officials accountable to our movement's demands. And activists fighting for Medicare for All and for free reproductive health care need to realize that we're fighting for the same thing. So we should be supporting each other's work and building coalitions to broaden and connect those two movements. And I'll end there.
Cities, and 14 years ago at age 19, I had an abortion in Atlanta, Georgia. My college boyfriend and I drove an hour and a half from Athens to Atlanta for the procedure, which is a much shorter drive than most people in the South have to make. To get to the clinic door, we had to pass by a crowd of loud, religious, anti-abortion protesters, mostly men, waving signs of bloody fetuses and Bible verses on them. This walk to the clinic door had a devastating effect on me. Even though I was sure of my decision and received expert and compassionate care from the clinic staff as soon as I was inside the clinic, the shame and guilt that those anti-abortion protesters planted festered in me for the next decade and was a factor in my decision to leave Georgia and move north. I share this story because I believe that normalizing abortion by sharing our stories as openly is a crucial step in fighting for reproductive freedom for all. Our demand should be based on our lives, not the expert opinions of policymakers. And separating the personal from the political is, and always has been, a losing strategy. To that end, and echoing what Anne said earlier, clearly we cannot leave the future of access to reproductive health in the hands of mainstream feminist organizations or the Democratic Party. The defensive strategy they have taken on abortion over the past 40 years, compromising with anti-choice politicians and moving the fight for abortion rights away from bodily autonomy and towards the right to privacy, has led to not only more restrictions on abortion, but allowed for the all-out attack on Planned Parenthood and other clinics and all the services they provide, including contraception. But what can we do? In the preface to the story of Jane, a history of the legendary underground feminist abortion service that operated in the years leading up to Roe versus Wade, Laura Kaplan writes about the legacy of the Jane Network this way. Jane is not an anomaly. It is part of a rich, radical tradition that posits that individuals working together can create the means of their own liberation. By that, I mean it is possible, in some circumstances, to envision a world that we wish existed and by our actions bring that world to life. When we see ourselves as actors rather than reactors, all kinds of possibilities are open to us. Instead of vainly banging on the doors of existing power, individuals empower themselves to, as it were, make their own doors, which is essentially what Jane did. When confronting the horrors of the current administration presents, Each of us needs to figure out how to address government policies that limit our rights and the rights of our neighbors and friends. And the important thing is to say yes, to start with what you can do right now and let people's needs guide your actions. So in the spirit of saying yes, I think we need a multi-pronged approach, like Anne mentioned, that addresses the needs of local communities, but also knits all of the local fights together so that we can all learn from and support each other as we strive to build a meaningful national movement for reproductive justice. We need an approach that sees fundraising for abortion access as just the beginning of the fight and also the very least we can do, an approach that goes beyond our bank accounts and into the streets. We must make our demands radical and strong, like Anne mentioned, not just safe, legal, and rare abortions, the pro-choice slogan that the Democrats popularized under Bill Clinton, but free abortion on demand without apology for all who want it. We're not here to help Roe versus Wade hold on by a thread. We're here to build a broad, unapologetic, and inclusive movement that seeks to abolish the shame and stigma around abortion and support reproductive justice for all, which should include free contraception, free childcare, comprehensive sex education, STI prevention and care, alternative birth options, adequate prenatal and pregnancy care, domestic violence assistance, adequate wages to support our families, affordable housing, and so much more. And a quick side note about reproductive justice, which is a term that DSA and other predominantly white socialist organizations now use regularly. It was a term that was invented by women of color who gathered in Chicago in 1994. And they recognized that the women's rights movement, led by and representing middle class and wealthy white women, could not defend the needs of women of color and other marginalized women and trans people. And these women named themselves the women of African descent for reproductive justice. And then that's when the term reproductive justice was born. And 3 years later, the Sister Song was formed to create a national multi-ethnic reproductive justice movement. And they've been doing the work to address the intersecting oppressions that impact the reproductive health of the most vulnerable for over 2 decades, long before this latest wave of abortion restrictions has brought this issue to the forefront of the national political debate once again. So on that note, Indigenous women, women of color, and trans people have always fought for reproductive justice. And in order for us to win this fight, it can't just be led by white women organizing in states like New York and Minnesota, like the three of us on this panel. It has to be a movement that centers on and is led by the most marginalized and those with the most at stake who are fighting in some of the most extreme political environments. Next year at Socialism, I want to attend a panel with 3 activists from the South talking about their organizing struggles and their victories. Yes. I want to hear from Sister Song and the folks from Yellowhammer Fund in Alabama and Spark Reproductive Justice Now in Atlanta, as well as the people working to keep Missouri's last abortion clinic open and activists mobilizing on the ground against Operation Save America in Milwaukee. And in a few minutes, I really want to hear from all of y'all about how you're organizing in your local communities, especially if you're from the South. But for now, I'll share a bit about what Twin Cities Clinic Defense is doing up in Minnesota. It's just even further north than here, if you can believe it. Twin Cities Clinic Defense, we're a pretty new coalition of folks from DSA, the former ISO, IWW, and some unaffiliated folks. And we formed after a really inspiring talk here last year given by Haley Archer and Michelle Farber on clinic defense. And I highly recommend you check it out if you haven't. It's very, very inspiring. We're still a young group and we have a lot of learning and listening to do, but in the past year, we've organized 2 clinic defenses, the first of which was in opposition to the closing rally for the fall campaign for 40 Days for Life. For those not familiar, 40 Days for Life is the largest internationally coordinated anti-choice mobilization in history, and they run 2 major campaigns each year in which they stand out in front of clinics for 40 days straight, praying and shaming patients who go into the clinic. At our first clinic defense, over 100 people came out in defense of abortion rights, and in lawful assembly, a radical marching band joined us, and they played Prince and Lizzo songs, and they drowned out the 40 Days for Life prayer rally, and they had to end up ending their rally an hour early, which I call a victory. On the anniversary of Roe vs. Wade, we held a public film screening and discussion of the documentary of I Had an Abortion, which is a film in which 11 people ranging from ages 21 to 85 share their abortion stories, cutting across race, religion, region, class, sexuality, and politics to show that abortion affects all people who can get pregnant. We organized a socialist feminist contingent for the Women's March Minnesota in January, and we were frustrated by the extremely tepid messaging that organizers of the Women's March in Minnesota were promoting. So we made a this giant red free abortion on demand banner, and we marched it up to the top of the Capitol steps in negative 2 degree temperatures. And we made this message the backdrop for the speakers at the rally that day. The same banner to block the misogynist anti-abortion signs of the religious bigots that came to protest the march, and other young people followed our lead, lending their own signs and flags to the effort. It's a very useful banner. We've participated in several fundraisers for abortion funds, including the Bullathon in support of Our Justice, a group that assists Minnesotans in accessing abortion care. And also two of the cooler members of our coalition, they are in a motorcycle group, and they organized the Ride for Reproductive Justice, which ended at a biker bar where they raffled off tattoo sessions, custom knives, tarot card readings, and more, and raised thousands of dollars for the Abortion Care Network. We organized a public speak out on the 50th anniversary of the 1969 Red Stocking speak out, in which radical feminists interrupted a New York legislature hearing of experts, again, mostly men, and one nun, on the future of abortion, filling the room with their own abortion stories. And in our speak out, people across generations shared their stories, and we talked about the path forward. And just quickly on our most recent action, it was an anti-CPC campaign that coincided with the DSA National Socialist Feminist Working Group's National Week of Action for Reproductive Justice. For those who aren't familiar, CPCs, or Crisis Pregnancy Centers, are anti-abortion counseling centers with an agenda. They use fear and shame to discourage patients from getting abortions, often using false advertising to make it appear that they provide health care. So Minnesota, way up north, we only have 4 abortion clinics, all of which are in urban centers, but we have 93 CPCs in the state, some of which are right across the street from the few abortion clinics left. So inspired by comrades in Pittsburgh, we created a pamphlet that talks about the dangers of CPCs and how to identify them, and also included actual resources for pregnancy tests, options counseling, STD testing, and abortion. And we organized a demonstration outside the CPC that is right across the street from Planned Parenthood in St. Paul, carrying signs that said this is not a doctor's office and this place lies to pregnant people, and we distributed pamphlets. And we have plans to repeat the action at as many CPCs around the Twin Cities metro area that we can. And we have several future things in the works, including a flash mob style direct action in celebration of what we're dubbing Reproductive Rights Day at the Minnesota State Fair, the largest state fair in the US. Members of our coalition are also meeting with the Minnesota State Auditor to address the state funding of CPCs in hopes of launching a campaign to get these fake health centers defunded. So these are just a few things that our coalition has done in the very short time that we've been together. We're kind of throwing everything to the wall and seeing what sticks. But again, I ask, how do we best fight this fight? How do we build a movement just as strong as the women's liberation movement of the 60s and 70s? And a movement that takes their demands even further and expands the fight for reproductive rights into reproductive justice for all. I think this is something we all need to figure out together using a variety of tactics. And we need to figure out how to combat the rise of the right and address this newfound boldness and respond just as boldly.
Thank you so much, guys. I think it's hard to follow those, but I will try. So my name is Ella. I'm an editor at Jacobin. And through that, my perspective on this is that through that, I've been able increasingly to edit a lot of our reproductive rights coverage at Jacobin. And in addition, I also edit a lot of our Latin America coverage, so I've gotten to get into the struggle in Argentina through that way, and learning about that has been pretty influential for me. And through this, I've gotten to have a little bit of a survey of the different questions that reproductive rights activists are grappling with right now, and the strategic questions that people are facing and that keep surfacing in article after article. And so I'm sort of just going to do a little bit of a survey of the main issues that I see and the conclusions that I think that we can draw from them, right? So the first thing that I see coming up a lot is the relationship of abortion rights to Medicare for All, which Anne talks about a little bit, and we can pose that more generally as like the relationship of particular demands to universal demands, right? Lillian Cicertia, who's also a member of New York for Abortion Rights, wrote a great article on this, and she really cautions us about a temptation on the left to use universal demands simplistically, and how that can backfire. In the case of Medicare for All, this can mean assuming that the class-wide appeal of Medicare for All is just going to transfer to its more controversial provisions, like coverage for abortion care. She really argues that there's dangers of this approach when it comes to reproductive justice, that without an offensive campaign on the issue of abortion rights, and a very visible one, that will be the first thing that can be compromised on. Either that, or Republicans will attack it immediately and just split Democratic support for Medicare for All as a whole, and be able to tank the bill. And so she argues very convincingly that we need to have an offensive campaign specifically about abortion rights in order to inoculate the base against these arguments in relation to Medicare for All, right? And I think it's a very strong argument. The one thing that I will say is that I think that there is a little bit of a danger of accepting this caution and turning it into a more general pessimism about the sort of transformative potential of universal demands. Because the issue isn't really about whether you lead with what unites us, it's about how you lead with it and to what end, right? So the usefulness of universal demands like Medicare for All isn't that they allow us to ignore hard or ugly conversations about our particular demands, but they are often misused that way on the left. Instead, we should be invested in them because they can set a more powerful framework in which to lead on particular demands. So instead of putting rights in competition with each other and within a framework of resentment and scarcity as the right does, we can put them in a framework of abundance and solidarity. And so I think that you can see this with the Hyde Amendment. The right is really able to attack funding for abortion rights within this framework of resentment and like, if I'm not getting healthcare coverage, then why should I be paying for someone's abortion, right? And I think that logic has a little bit less pull when we are saying, no, this is not an environment of scarcity. We don't have to compete against each other. Everybody can get the healthcare that they need, and that includes abortion, right? You can see this a similar logic in lots of other areas, like, for example, the right likes to attack SNAP recipients and limit what kind of food they should be able to eat, pass laws saying that if you smoke in your apartment, then you should be evicted from public housing. This is all a currency of resentment of who is deserving, what kind of needs are deserving and moral versus what kind of needs are undeserving and immoral. And if we have a framework like Medicare for All that's about not putting different needs and rights in competition with each other, I think that is a more powerful framework for arguing for our particular demands, right? So that's one thing that I see a lot of our writers talking about. The second one is just asking, what is the socialist argument for abortion rights versus the liberal argument? You know, the first of all, I think that, as I referenced before, we can talk about the right's paternalistic argument against abortion as not occurring in a vacuum. It occurs in the same discursive framework that animates the right's other suppressions on the rights of poor people, like I talked about before, like with SNAP recipients, like with public housing tenants, right? And they're able to manufacture consensus for gutting social spending by pitting the deserving against the undeserving, the legitimate needs against the illegitimate needs. And I think that the crusade against abortion is part of a sort of general effort to create a zero-sum logic among workers that pits them against each other for scarce resources. And the interesting thing here is the role of the courts as well, that I think doesn't go discussed enough, because as Anne talked about, it's kind of unclear whether these sections of the conservative movement that want to fully overturn Roe are going to be successful, and that there do appear to be other sections of the right that don't see the need for that. And I think that's related to the fact that the status quo for abortion rights right now is actually kind of useful for the right, in that it creates this whole apparatus of court control over women's actions. Even without abortion being entirely legal, you do make working class women and poor women very dependent on the courts for appealing to them for their rights. You know, like, I have to go to court to prove that I was raped or that I'm a victim of incest and be humiliated in front of this court in order to get the care that I need, right? And I think that that sort of apparatus of arbitration and dependence on the courts to get our rights is kind of useful for the right, and maybe more useful than making it outright illegal, right? And that's, I think that we can make those connections to sort of generalize the particular injustice of anti-abortion laws to the more general injustice of the working class, right? And second, I think that we can stand to really introduce more class-based language of who benefits and who suffers from abortion restrictions. Because even liberal narratives that touch on this, they talk about quote-unquote disproportionate effects on poor women and women of color of anti-abortion laws, and they present this disparity very passively, like they're the result of a sort of inexorable tendency that no one is responsible for. There's no clash of interests between the interests of poor women and powerful people, right? We don't know why poor women are disproportionately affected in the passive sense, right? Who is affecting them? And I think that we can stand to introduce a language of, you know, working class women are forced to bear children that they don't want, or into back alley abortions, or into being humiliated in front of courts to adjudicate whether they were really raped or not, and whether they really deserve an abortion. And meanwhile, wealthy people will always be able to travel or contract a private doctor to get the private and the dignified care that they need. You know, working class people will always bear the financial and the logistical burdens of unwanted children, and wealthy people will never have to. So the left should really emphasize those contradictions at every turn and demand that what appears now as a privilege for the rich should be made a right for everybody, basically. And the third thing, I'm gonna skip a little bit. Anne already talked about how abortion rights is way more popular than anyone really thinks. There's a misperception that it's this really unpopular and divisive demand, but majorities in support of abortion rights do exist in the American public, and they've actually gotten higher over the past decade, and Also, they get higher when we actually fight publicly for them, right? And so we should emphasize this to show that, because the right really has an argument that when we fight for abortion rights, that we're sort of like elitist feminist types ramming our opinions down the majority's throat that doesn't want this like controversial demand. And actually we're the majority and they are the minority that is like undemocratically forcing these restrictions down people's throats. And what's more, it really gives an excuse for Democratic politicians to concede on this issue because they act like, oh, I'm just doing what voters want, when often the opposite is true, right? So I'm at my time, so I'm gonna wrap up now, but I think that we'll probably get to some of the other themes that I see in our coverage in the discussion. Yeah, so thank you so much.